Welcome to Gorgeous Entertainment on Radio Gorgeous. Today we have Ellen Daniels with her one-woman show, Emotional Terrorism, which will be playing at the Drayton Arms Pub and Theater from December 5th to December 9th. Show starts at 9:15. The promotional materials described this show as the show charts Ellen's life of Paris runways, ballet dancing, world travel, parties at Hollywood mansions, and the dark underbelly of the seemingly glamorous life, bulimia, blacking out, and sitting on the precipice of suicide. A jolly show.
Welcome, Ellen.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So tell us a bit about the, in a bit more detail about the show and how it came about.
Okay. The show is about a sort of little sections of my life, and basically the time from my childhood to moving to Los Angeles when I was 22. So it sort of charts like my beginnings as a ballet dancer, aspirations as a ballet dancer, the early like sexualization by ballet teachers, getting scouted by a modeling agent in Paris when I was 17 on a business trip with my father, moving to Paris at 17 to start modeling, being sent to Tokyo to model, starting to be bulimic along with the modeling because I was there was a lot of pressure on me to lose weight and maintain a certain level of weight, and then eventually moving to Los Angeles where I started to pursue acting, and eventually I got into stand-up comedy after that.
We were talking earlier and you said a lot of things happened for you, you know, when you got to LA, like a lot happened too early. Mm-hmm. And that sounds like that was throughout.
Yeah,
starting with your early life. Tell me about like the starting with the ballet dancing, because it mm-hmm. sounds like you were quite driven.
Mm-hmm. I was really driven. I've always been a driven person, but the drive would always cross a line into obsession, and I understand that now better through the lens of addiction. Because I'm sober, I am an alcoholic, I am a drug addict. I mean, I don't use or drink now, but that kind of mentality is a very extreme mentality. So I can, my addictive nature, I can put into anything, you know, food, ballet, career. It's hard for me, balance is something I struggle with. And I came from a home where that kind of mentality was really prevalent. So there wasn't a lot of advocation for balance, you know? So I, when I got into ballet, it was actually a bit late because I was studying at what we would call disparagingly a Dolly Dingle studio, which would be a place where you do tap, jazz, ballet, competitions at hotels, like, you know, a bit more cheesy dance moms type vibe. And but I always, you know, kind of stood out in ballet class, and whatever ballet teacher happened to be there would always say to me, oh, you have real potential as a ballet dancer. One guy did tell me, you should go to School of American Ballet, you need to get out of here. He also told my mother that, and I think that really terrified her because I don't think that she could really fathom what that meant. We were in Orlando. We went to this school. Like, we knew everybody that was there. And suddenly this guy's going, you should call this school in New York City where your daughter should then go and live. You know, it just was, I think, outside of her spectrum. I really wanted to go. When he said that to me, I thought, oh, great. I'm special. Do you know what I mean? I could get out of here. There's something else waiting for me, because I did have this feeling being in Orlando, and I still have it when I'm there, like, I need to get out of here. I don't belong here. I really have that feeling. And I know that's a very classic feeling of people who are addicts and alcoholics, like, I need to be special. I need to be, but I just didn't feel my soul there. You know, I felt kind of culturally deprived. So ultimately, I ended up auditioning for the local ballet school that was like the ballet place. There I met a man called Vasile. Vasile was this Romanian guy who'd come in and taken over the company. He's trying to save it. He was like, all right, look, you're really talented, but you're weak and you really have to work hard to catch up. This is not going to be easy. Are you going to be able to do this? Of course, I thought, yes, absolutely. I'm going to do this. My mom was terrified, you know, like, what? So he told me I had to come and take twice the classes of everybody else, do twice the work, all that stuff. Well, to me, it became great because it was a way for me to channel all of this anxiety and energy and everything and just have this goal, which is that I need to become great and I need to get to the level I should be. Within a year then, I auditioned for a boarding school called the Herod Conservatory, which is actually in Boca Raton, Florida. And they take like 20 people per year or something, not even per year, but there's 20 students at a time. Everyone's there on a full tuition scholarship because they had a big endowment. So I really liked that. It was like all equal, you know, and I got in there and then I went to that school. And so it was an interesting thing where I'd never really studied ballet. I'd never really known very much about it at all, other than the little tidbits I'd get from these women at the Dolly Dinkle School, whose experience was very limited. So suddenly I'm thrust into an environment with kids who are ballet obsessed. They'd been living and breathing this. They had their favorite Baryshnikov ballet tapes. They had their favorite Sylvie Guillem performances. I didn't even know who the hell these people were, you know? So I was like a little bit late to the party, but I just knew, like, okay, I just have to really be perfect. I have to push myself to be able to do this. And I think that, you know, ultimately that mentality became very debilitating because it didn't, I was always trying to please like somebody outside myself, the teachers, the faculty. I always wanted to get the part. I wanted to get promoted. I wanted to get this. So it, you know, only when I was on stage could I really be free to experience the pleasure that was dancing, when you have the freedom to do it without wondering what everybody's thinking about you. So I think I always had that too in my life. Like, I wanted people to think that I was good.
Okay, but so how does that, and all of that focus, mm-hmm. and I have to, you know, practice, and I've got to be best, and I've got to get the prima ballerina roles, and I've got to do this. Then you're in Paris and be like, oh, actually, you know what? I'm going to model.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say is, I think that's one of those interesting things where it's like, I mean, it's not interesting at all. It's actually quite boring. It's like, oh, if things aren't going my way, then I better jump ship and get into something else, which I think is in some, I mean, it's very, very addict-y, but it's also very American. It's like, okay, wait a second. I can't be the best at this. Well, then screw that. I'm going to do something I can be the best at. And I think I had a little tinge of that with that modeling agent. Mm-hmm. Because the director of my school, he was like very mentally manipulative and abusive. And I was injured. I had sustained this injury to my ankle. It was bad. I needed to take 6 months off in reality. That was not going to happen there. You know, everybody was giving me crap all the time. When are you coming back? When are you coming back? When are you going to be in class? And I'm like, fuck. And my foot was like in so much pain. I mean, I knew I shouldn't be on the foot, but I was like, all right, I'm going to go back because I don't want to get harassed. And this guy told me, he got very, very angry at me about several things. But one was that I wrote a letter to this kid that I kind of had a crush on who made our sandwiches on Saturday. And I told him that the food normally was shit at the school, which it totally was. But the director of the school was like, you've hurt John's feelings. That was the caterer and all this stuff. He's like, Ellen, you know, I don't know what's wrong with you. Like, you have a very, very, like, bitter seed inside of you. I mean, I know your parents are good people, but there's something wrong with you. He was, like, really laid into me and said, you know, you're a good dancer and you're a good student, but if it weren't for those things, I would have you out of here in your ass in a heartbeat because I don't like your attitude. I don't like the way you look at yourself in the mirror. It disgusts me. I had donors in the classroom and you were looking at yourself all, like, self-satisfied, admiring yourself. I mean, it was, like, horrifying, the things he said to me. And I'm 14 going, what? get. You just don't, you didn't expect that to come from somebody that you're kind of looking to for support. And I remember my teacher was in the same conference and he was like, I don't know, just how looking in the mirror. I don't know. You know, but he wouldn't defend me because he didn't want to lose his job. So I want to get away from that guy as well. And I think also my parents were very like hands off in a way. I said, I want to write a letter to the board. People shouldn't be treated like this. This is terrible. They're like, no. Don't cause any, you know. So I felt very abandoned and betrayed by like many people around
me. You're very isolated.
Yeah, very isolated. So again, when I'm in this
very vulnerable.
Yeah, totally vulnerable. And like, you know, and later I found out from so many people that this man had done similar, if not worse, things to them. They had been in therapy for years. Like so many therapists were employed because of this guy, you know. And so, but everybody's looking at me. My parents are like, you're crazy. You're overreacting. Olivier, my teacher, was just like, sorry. He's kind of like apologizing in the background, like, sorry. So I think when I'm walking in Paris, I'm in the subway and somebody goes, excuse me. Are you a model? Da-da-da. It's again that feeling like somebody sees me. You know, I have a chance again to be special, to be seen. And I think that really comes into the show a lot, and something that I try to like bring at the end of the show. It's like really all I wanted was to be seen, you know, for who I was by my parents. I mean, really, it comes down to your parents, doesn't it? Always at the end of the day. So it's like I'm trying to get on TV because my dad is obsessed with watching television. You know, that's why I want to be on TV. Not because I really want to be on TV. Not because I love the material so much that I'm getting to audition for. You know, so it's kind of like you betray your destiny in a way by going towards this this subconscious. At the time, it was a very subconscious desire. I just wanted to be approved upon, you know? And when somebody would present me with like, if you do this, you could become very successful. I got obsessed with like being in a magazine, you know, or being on a billboard. I mean, it sounds so ridiculous, but it's actually what happens, I think, to a lot of people. Because we're deifying celebrities in this culture. So of course, as a kid, if your house is full of like Vogue magazines and you know your parents are really into the TV shows and the characters on TV and they're like talking about them like they're your friends, you're going to start to think, well, okay, I've got to get on TV or I've got to get in one of these magazines because that is what makes you important. That's what gives you power, you know?
And that's where I'll be seen.
Yeah, and that's where I'll be noticed. Yeah. And that will be important. And
well, and okay, so but how do you get yourself out of that cycle? Because it doesn't sound wildly different to me. I mean, it sounds very destructive. And also with no sort of ballast to this. Mm-hmm. You didn't have any sort of normalizing ballast.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine you were very determined once you know, the idea of modeling in Paris came up. You're like, okay, great, now mm-hmm. I'm doing that. That's the mm-hmm. next thing. But what, and you started getting more and more self-destructive,
mm-hmm.
you know, more bulimic. You've mentioned you were turning to alcohol, and we've talked passing out, bulimia, etc. What brings you back from the brink?
I was on the brink for so long, and
that sounds like that was like the normal place.
Yeah, the brink was normalcy.
That was your.
Yeah, you know, like I started drinking when I was really young. I mean, 7, I would drink sometimes with like sneak my parents' booze, and I remember getting drunk when I was 7. So I always had booze in my life. Like there was always destructive drinking. Whenever I drank, it was pretty destructive. But okay, so I moved to Los Angeles when I'm 22. I keep living my life in this way where, and there was that kind of dichotomy of the person who's super determined, super, you know, like coming to LA, not knowing anyone. Soon I'm getting in a Spike Jonze directed commercial when he was directing like really exciting things. So people are paying attention to me. Then I'm getting like Good Agent. Then I'm getting on a TV show. Then I'm getting this, like a bit, you know, a guest star role. But it was like, oh, how did this person go from not knowing anyone to this, like within a year? But then there would be that other side of me that would be destructive, drinking. If something didn't go my way, I would feel like it was the end of the world. Things were gonna, you know. So it was that paradox, and I kept living my life like that. I did, you know, I got into a relationship, which I think in a way saved my life, because I was engaged to this man for 4 years, and he, while we shared a love of booze and that kind of thing, he brought some kind of, as you say, a ballast. Maybe it was a bit of a shaky one, but there was something, you know, holding me. We had this like bond, and you know, he had a bigger family, so I also became close with them. So I think that kind of, and he helped me get into stand up, and I think he kept me from going really, really far into the destruction, because I had somebody I was accountable to. But ultimately, I, because of myriad reasons, I got out of that relationship, and I thought that was my problem. You know what I mean? You think that it's, and it took me basically drinking. I mean, I ended up going to Berlin, living with a model friend of mine for a while, getting into another relationship there. It was just like bonkers, you know. Then I'm suddenly like, I'm gonna marry this guy, this Israeli guy that's living in Berlin, and we're gonna open a Pilates studio together. I mean, at that point I was like, I'm done with this business, because my partner, my previous partner, he was also very ambitious, and so I think our mutual ambition choked the relationship. You know, it was like everything needs to go towards our careers going well, and so there was no real love left, you know. And I feel like we've sort of rekindled that as friends subsequently, but during that last period, it was like I did start to have a spiritual awakening of sorts. I didn't know what was happening, but I just suddenly thought, I can't live like this. This can't be my life. So I thought maybe that life in Berlin was going to be the life or whatever. But ultimately, I ended up drinking every day. Like, I couldn't answer an email without drinking. I couldn't, like, I was so reliant on the booze to deal with my emotions, which I couldn't deal with, all this stuff. So I went to a therapist. I was asking her to do, like, EMDR work on me, like, you know, like, trauma, to relieve me of this memory of something that I felt that I'd done, and I explore that in the show, so I won't tell what it is, that was so awful that I could never recover from having done this horrible thing. Could she erase that from my mind? And then she just said, are you an alcoholic? And I was like, fuck you. You know, I was like really resistant to that. But she basically told me, I won't treat you unless you get help, unless you go to AA and like 12-step recovery programs. So then I started going there, and that's how I got back to any kind of you know, balance in my life. And it took a long time. I mean, I'm like three years and 8 months clean and sober, and like just now I feel that I'm getting to a place where I don't have to freak out if, you know, something doesn't tick the way I thought it was supposed to tick, or, you know. And the shame, I carried such shame of being a failure with me my entire life, and that's kind of starting to lift now. So yeah, it took that. I mean, it took me just being like I just wanted to die. Like, I just didn't wanna, when I would wake up in the morning, I'd be so angry that I woke up. And I think it took being there and not dying to go, okay, well, either I have to really do something extreme, or I need to fix this, because I can't live like this. You know, this is like insanity. And it becomes you don't see the pattern of how you're living until one day you actually see it and you go, oh my God, this has been 6 months like this, or this has been, yeah.
Scary.
Yeah, very it's scary. Really scary.
Okay, so, and with, but with a sort of a tangled, I would say, history with performance, what is it about, what does performing do now? And also with a very personal and a very sort of raw
story,
unapologetic, you know, raw story. Mm-hmm. What is performing that do for you? And what's your relationship with performing mm-hmm. now?
Well, in this particular piece, well, I mean, okay, so I'll say, like, my relationship to performing separately from this piece, just in general, performing stand-up, improv, comedy, dancing, whatever I'm doing, to me, that's where I feel the most alive. So when I perform, something kicks in that otherwise I don't really experience fully. So I feel there the most alive. Now, that's changed slightly. Like, I have more of a, it's less of a jump, but I still don't, there's nothing quite like performing. I don't know that, we'd have to study that for a really long time to know what the psychological root of that is, but this piece in particular did something interesting for me that I did not know it was going to do, which was that it gave me, performing the piece gave me self-compassion, because, which I never ever had really. I it was such an abstract concept for me that when people would say you need to be kind to yourself, I really didn't know what they were talking about until somebody told me, try taking a bath. You know, it had to be something, an action that I could understand. So this, a more of a psychological concept of being kind to yourself, giving yourself a break, didn't really come to me. And so I started performing this piece. And as I'm acting out, like, these experiences that I had, or what drove me to start putting my finger down my throat and puking, or how I felt when I had done this thing, I had betrayed my friend and I had to call and tell her what I'd done, and how I didn't have anyone to call. Like, I had no one to say, this is what's going on and I'm really scared. You know, I just didn't have that support network. It gave me a lot of compassion for myself doing this. And
is it because you see, like, when you're acting,
yeah, so
whatever it is, even if it, you wrote the role,
mm-hmm.
that you have, you see it as a role and you have compassion for that person.
Yeah.
And then, oh, right, that person's me.
Right.
That was me.
Exactly. You know? And I always feel that acting is, for me, has always been a very spiritual thing. So no matter, I always try to find something about the character that's like, I don't like actively seek it out. It just happens where suddenly, like, you're channeling something and it may be, you know, part of my mother's story that I channel if I'm doing a certain person who feels less than, or who feels that they're trying to fit into a world that they don't feel that they belong in, or, you know, so you can kind of grab these things almost from your history, from your lineage. And it's strange sometimes when you're like, oh my God, this is exactly me. And then I can see that, because when I look back at myself now as, you know, older Ellen, I look back at myself, I used to just think, that was so stupid. Why'd you do that? You fucked that up. God, that was a terrible decision. And I wouldn't take into consideration where I was at the time when I made that decision. I didn't have all the knowledge I have now.
Has it made you more compassionate to your parents?
Yeah, I think it made me more compassionate to, like, or just say, like, yes, it of course made me more compassionate to my parents, and also grateful to them. Because what I realized doing the show in Edinburgh and, like, doing it night after night after night, and I would always have to pray before I did it, like, to be you know, I always try to say, like, to have the intention to bring the audience something that they will feel, something that they need to feel, or, you know, and to honor the journey that I've been on that would then allow me to tell this story. And of course, if I hadn't had my exact two parents, I wouldn't be standing there performing that story. I wouldn't have the 50-year-old Scottish man crying, telling me that that moved him. So that all goes back to them, you know?
Anyway. Ellen, thank you so much. Good luck.
Thank you.
Again, go to our website, www.radiogorgeous.com, for all the details for Ellen's show. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.